operators, and this bill would exempt electric cooperatives from financial responsibility requirements for terminal operators in Alaska Statute 46-440. And this issue was around last year. I believe it was first in the Oil and Gas Committee, and Naknek Electric and Nushagak Electric brought it to my attention. And what happened in Oil and Gas, I believe, the bill was in the committee, and I thought that in the process that certain things had been resolved, and then it was brought back to my attention that, you know, things weren't resolved. I guess what Nushagak and Naknek believe that this was just like a one-time only solution. And with the turnover in my staff, I wasn't directly involved in the issue, so I, you know, turned it over to staff, and so I need, what I need to do is find out what the co-ops have to say and give me the history of the issue, and then also I'd like to have DEC, you know, tell me their side of the story too. And I won't move the bill today, but I'd like to take testimony because there's people from out of town. Claude, do you want to come up and kind of give us the history of the issue as you see it? And then also I have some information for you guys.
My name is Claude Frank, and I'm general manager of the Naknek Electric Association, and been here for the past 4.5 years. I have approximately 45 years in the utility business, commencing with a ground person and ultimately serving as a general manager for about a 20-year period. I have experience in generation, transmission, substation, distribution, and the operation of the utility. This goes back a long time in my life, as you can tell. I'm a short timer, just about ready to step out of the saddle. I was introduced to the utility business by an uncle of mine who operated a municipal system in southern Minnesota, and thereby, you might say, as a child, I was ingrained in electricity is good, electricity is cheap, and electricity is the way to do things. So, and I've lived my life pretty much the same way. And I've looked forward to attempting to reduce costs where possible and reasonable, and still provide sound, good economic electric service. I showed up on the Alaska scene in the fall of 1982, and of course when you start in a new system, you start looking at numbers and various information that's available, and places that you can do something about cost. And one of the most apparent places that we could do something about cost at Naknek Electric Association was the $1.14 fuel price we were paying. Early on in the spring of that year, I've been asked to bring you up to date on this, how this all came to be and why we're involved in this, and this is why I'm going to spend 5 or 10 minutes on this. we attempted to negotiate with our vendor at that point in time, who had the local bulk facility at Naknek for a lesser price of fuel. And we couldn't seem to get their ear. We threatened them with the possible construction of some oil storage facilities so that we could go to the open market for pure fuel. They evidently didn't believe us, and we still could not get their attention. So the next consequence, of course, was we went out for bids and built a 500,000-gallon tank the following year and two more the next year, giving us a total storage capacity of 1.6 million. This storage facility is set on the property of Naknek Electric Association, which is surrounded by fence. The facility itself is all impounded, and the topography of the property itself enables us to retain a secondary spill area if any spill should occur. Well, anyhow, to get back to my story with the storage facility, we went to bid. We reduced our fuel price by $0.89 the first year. The second year, to 84 cents, and last year we bought fuel for 79 cents, which was a little high for the market at the time, but we were forced to that position. This fuel purchasing exercise reduced our fuel costs by about 2.5 cents a gallon. And this was affected in the fuel cost section of our rate, the fuel cost adjuster. And this was automatically given to each consumer as well as passed on to the BCE program, which benefited from it also. So, to make a long story short, we built the storage facilities with proper Coast Guard overview with engineering facilities. We hired an environmental consultant to prepare our containment and contingency plan. We have all of the necessary facilities, a boom, which we share with Nushvac, that they take oil with us. And I might also say at this, the second year in our building program, Nushvac joined us and also built a facility. So we are two neighbors on Bristol Bay, both with large storage facilities, and we are, both have the same problem. But what this amounted to was a fine reduction in the cost of energy for the NACNAC or the Bristol Bay people and the Power Cost Equalization Program. And lo and behold, the first year that we took fuel, we were given a variance by DEC in a sense, because we just weren't prepared, I guess, to give the financial responsibility that they're asking of us. And the second year, we made other arrangements with Eureka and our CFC financing arm in Washington, D.C., to give us a line of credit to which satisfied. Well, then, that brings us to last year's situation, in which we brought model legislation by Representative Herman in an attempt to be taken out of the legislature, the law. And I guess we feel that we should be taken out in that the law was written in 1981 when a great deal of exploration and such things were going about, and some need of control was apparent. But we feel that being local people, owned by local people, certainly are not going to go out and do anything to disturb our way of life and our financial and economic way of life. I feel that if we had a spill in our community, every soul in the community would have a shovel in their hand to attempt to keep that oil from getting to the river. That river is our livelihood. And we keep a tidy place. We have there's no sign of any trying to fracture the law. I might go back one step to you, and I hate to ramble like this because I was not going to comment on this phase at all. But when we take fuel, we acquire fuel in approximately 30,000 barrels for Nutrigac and ourselves. As a barge comes to our dock, we have a pipeline 1,800 feet long, 4-inch line, and we pump fuel for approximately 48 hours. There is a two barge watchman, there is a manifold watchman, one of our employees, 24 hours a day, and we also have a patrolman walking the line. And when we're done pumping our fuel, we go to the manifold and insert a mouse, a rubber sponge ball, and prime the line to 125, a line compartment to 125 pounds of pressure, purge this ball through the line up into our storage tank, so thereby it vacates the fuel line. And Nutrigac does the same thing. So this then puts all the responsibility of spillage back in our particular area. And this means that we would have to have, we feel, some catastrophic thing that would ever get fuel back to the river itself. And Nutrigak has a beautiful facility at this point in time. They've spent a goodly sum of money for diking, impound, and the equipment that's necessary. We feel that DEC is putting us to unnecessary cost to go out and buy spill insurance. Our spill insurance coverage this year was taken on by a consortium veil of corporations, and I really don't feel that we probably are getting the coverage that we're paying for. We're paying $10,000. This equates to about 3/4 mil per kilowatt hour delivered to our NACNAC Electric. And it's paying for something that we're taking care of ourselves, and certainly would clean up ourselves. But back to the insurance company, it's a claims-made policy with $1 million per incident, or aggregate of $2 million with a $25,000 deductible. And we feel with our local people and the local equipment we have, if we had a spill, we would probably clean it up within the deductible site, the amount. So the there's question in my mind that we would be able to collect the claim from the three principals. The original carrier is the Planning Corporation of Illinois, which I'm sure you've all heard of, I doubt it. And then we get the International Surplus Lines, and then below that, Crum and Foster. Well, there's no question about Crum and Foster. They have very adequate footing. But the other two just seem to be turnkey-type things that they're taking advantage of this type of insurance coverage. And they, incidentally, are the only people that would write coverage for us in the state of Alaska. The only sole one. There were two. And when one found out it was Alaska and the Bush, they wouldn't talk to us. So we were caught with this particular policy, costing us $10,000, and it just doesn't appear that it's money well spent. And I think DEC is being unreasonable by not permitting us to take care of our own house. I've rambled, and I'd like to apologize for it. It isn't really what I was going to say, but I guess I've covered it. I'd be happy to answer any questions that I might have created.
Yeah, Claude, a couple of questions here. You said, is it one-time only insurance, or?
No, this is not a one-time only. This coverage probably would be available for years to come if we would sit down and be willing to pay for it.
Okay, and then who was the burden on before for proof of financial responsibility when, the co-op wasn't involved in directly getting fuel,
we were outside of the 10,000 barrel limitation at that point in time. We only had 175,000 gallons, and we never carried that much at one time because it was transferred from the tenant vendor to our tank.
Was it on the vendor though?
The vendor carried it, yes.
The insurance then?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was financial responsibility. They carried no insurance.
Just a question to you, Madam Chairman. I'm just wondering, would this have any other ramifications for any other utilities? You know, I'm just thinking on the top of my head, I wonder, like some grass.
I'm not sure. I think there's four.
Now well, we're talking go. About marine-type facilities where we're coming into the water. It would be the west coast of Alaska and Cordova possibly, but the west coast of Alaska primarily. Kotzebue, Norway.
Why?
It's not limited.
Yeah.
It's not limited, but it's the marine facility that drives the interest because we're pumping that amount. Because you have another vendor involved usually.
I don't know.
It's the fact we're buying at such large volume.
How big is
that? Well, I don't know. It's just a question.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know. I was wondering if it had some long range. Or I was wondering about Eagle, for example.
Well, just, I don't know.
Okay.
I had a question on that particular point there.
I'll follow that point up,
okay,
too.
Okay.
Well, it talks about the, doesn't apply to electric cooperatives incorporated under 1025, which is the Electric Telephone Cooperative Act, so it sounds like it would apply to any electric co-op.
That operates an oil terminal facility.
That operates an oil terminal facility. Which
so it's not necessarily marine. An electric co-op in the interior that had an oil terminal, for any words, I guess what you mean by that is a storage tank facility. This bill applies to.
Of what, 10,000 gallon or more?
Barrels.
For 10,000.
Isn't it barrels?
Yeah, yeah, barrels. Yeah.
10,000 barrels.
I have a couple other questions. Just so I understand what the point is, what, in terms of the percentage of stored fuel that can be retained in your facilities, what is your retention capability?
I feel that we could retain all of ours if we were totally full. However, the loss is 110%, and there's no problem.
It's 110% of your largest tank,
vessel.
Isn't it?
Largest vessel.
Okay. But, so how many vessels do you have?
We have five. We have three 500,000 and two 85,000.
Okay, so, but your retention, you think you can retain the whole?
Yes, on our property.
On your property?
Yes.
In primary or secondary retention?
Using both.
And if I read the letter, Madam Chairman, I used to run a fuel facility, that's why. Private, though, we weren't subject to this small one. I understand there's two parts in these letters where basically you're saying that if we have a spill, we will clean it up without constraints of law imposing a financial burden upon us. And a later letter to Representative Herman from Dave Hutchins saying a utility isn't going anywhere. If a spill occurs, they will still be there and have the financial ability to pay for the cleanup. Kind of reading between the lines, it appears to me that you're saying that you don't want to carry the insurance. If a spill occurs, you will pay for the cost of cleanup, and if the state pays any cost of cleanup, you are willing to pay the state back and increase your utility rates to a sufficient degree to pay the state back for any costs that they incur.
That's correct.
Madam Chairman, I gather that's where they're going. Basically, they're saying a utility is almost like a sovereign in the sense that they are going to ultimately be financially responsible. And they don't need to carry this insurance because they're going to be there and they can just roll it into their rate base. What we don't have here is a statement in the legislation anywhere that that they want to take this risk on their own, that they want to not buy insurance but take the risk that they will cover the costs that the state would incur. And my only concern is that without the insurance, if there is a spill, we're going to have a disaster declared and we're going to go on the disaster relief fund to pay for the state's costs. And if I understand the speaker here, he says that the utilities are willing to pay back the disaster relief fund by increasing their rates and pay for it. And if that's the case, I wouldn't have any problem. That's just a self-insurance mechanism.
That's right. This is what we feel.
That isn't what the legislation says, but that's what your position
it's
is.
It's exempting us, and I guess when we exempt ourselves, if we still have to answer the law. We have to clean up.
Yeah, but if you don't have the ability to pay for it, the state's going to come in and pay for it, and then the mechanism how to get the state paid back is not covered in
but
there.
But we do have the mechanism to pay for it through rate and tariff.
I understand that, and you understand that. I'm not.
Yeah.
That's not what the legislation
says. What we are applying.
Yeah, you appreciate it. Thank you.
That really addressed my question. It sounds like, according to the letter here from DEC, Randy Bayless, right now you have the ability to show financial responsibility by self-insurance.
We don't feel we do. We're trying to encumber, we feel, any needed capital improvements for the system, and this is, of course, the primary objective, is to provide good service continuity. And if we restrict our financial ability or capability of borrowing additional funds, and REA is becoming very difficult to get money from today, so we have to use other sources. So we would rather not have the encumbrance hanging over our head. I think it would tie our hands.
The encumbrance meaning a self-insurance,
yes.
Method of showing financial,
yes,
responsibility.
If we had to commit dedicated funds for that, per se.
Well, how else can you show self-insurance unless you assume some burden. I think that's what President Sun was getting to.
Well, this is what we're asking for, is relief of this. And with the thought that we would, or promise, or whatever you want, that we would clean it up if we had a spill.
Well, that's sort of, you seem like you're trying to go in a circle here. I mean, in order to promise, you have to assume some legal burden there, I believe.
Well, I guess I can remember my grandfather buying a farm on a shake of a hand, and I think that we people in a rural area have a lot more concern about our areas, and we'll take care of them. I don't think that you have to put blood down in order to do it. I think it works.
Rip Sands, you know, today I want to just, bring out both sides to it, and, not necessarily pass it out, but just, take your considerations, your concerns into consideration.
I think we're just trying to clarify what I thought I understood him saying,
yeah.
I think Representative Cotton, but I say you don't want to encumber an existing pot of money. But in my answer to my question, I thought you said you were willing to encumber your rate base.
Well, this will have to happen if we have a spill to raise money. At this point in time, there's no reason
to. Well, it doesn't have to happen.
No.
Most people run to the state and ask the state to pay for it.
Well, I don't think that if this is a particular case, we haven't done this in the past. It hasn't been the part.
Anything like that has somewhere along the line a cost-risk equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're talking about. Have we got any indication from the state's Division of Risk Management how they view it? The reason I ask is that we wrestled with exactly the same type of indemnity questions on the Red Dog project. And we got the Division of Risk Management involved to see what, number one, the statistical chances of occurrence are, and then equate that in relationship to the premium that is required, and the premium would have to be passed on to the per kilowatt cost, and at what point it would be prudent either for the utility to self-insure it or for the state to take over a rider policy if the risk probabilities are really low. I mean, the state can get involved two ways, either through the disaster provisions,
mm-hmm.
which is an after-the-fact type deal, or you can get involved by using an umbrella state policy from risk management if the risks are really minimal. And I think those risks, if the containment systems and all the provisions are met, are minimal.
The same as our insuring our schools.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Same issue.
The Coast Guard, don't they observe the whole process too? And what are
they inspect
there for?
Excuse me, I might. The Coast Guard inspects our facility each year prior to pumping.
Yeah.
And aren't they on, there when you're contracted?
They, last year, the two last years they have been there. I don't know whether it was they planned it that way or what, but they were there for the first 2 days of pumping.
For sending the bar.
Yeah, I appreciate your problem with the insurance, but I mean this is kind of overall just a piecemeal approach. We have a lot of problems in the state with insurance, and I think that the potential, I guess, impact of a spill needs to be insured again somehow. I'm just wondering, what would be the cost if you had a spill? Just say a worst case scenario. If you had a spill, what's the total capacity of your...
Well, last year we took on about 1 million gallons, and we had about 250 remaining, so you're talking about 1.25 million gallons total. And the worst scenario probably would be at the earthquake taking down all storage facility, and I say worst case, if the ground were cracked and opened and this oil got into the subterranean, I guess I have no idea what it would cost to clean up a mess like that.
So
it would be,
What I'm trying to find out is if you have the loss and you have to clean up that, plus you have to buy new fuel to some degree, how's that going to impact your rates? I mean, if you're going to pick up this cost. See, what I see happening is just a roll of the dice, unless we set up some provision like Mr. Springer suggested. It's the roll of the dice. If it happens, you work from there to try to figure out some way to take care of it, and the only thing I can see off in the future is disaster relief.
Well, you asked me the worst case, and I cited this. Probably a more reasonable thing would be a leaking pipe on our facility, a cracked tank, a seepage, something of this nature. And with the dike impoundment and being of the aggregate it is, it's volcanic sand, and percolation in that is next to nil. If you go to some of the older oil facilities, garages, so on and so forth, and look out the back door, you'll see a pretty hard crusted area of soil there, and you can't pour anything into it. It just won't absorb it. It's the impaction is so much, and that's it.
Okay, have you got any an analysis of what the risk would be? Different probabilities? Because you said
I
don't think it would ever happen, or we think we'd be able to take care of anything, and I appreciate your evaluation, but...
I guess I feel probably, not technically necessarily, but I have lived with it, and I've looked at it, and I've worked on it to try to make it as permanent as possible. And I would say our exposure is practically nothing because of our retention capability.
Okay, how about statewide? Do you have any idea?
I can't speak for that.
So this is...
I can speak for Dillingham and our facility.
Okay. This is going to impact any of...
Would be any electric cooperative.
Yeah, I don't know how many there are.
Well, there...
Or how many there might be at some point in the future.
Well, you know, there's larger problems than this that you aren't really addressing, and probably with more impact. And that's facilities of less than 10,000 gallons without any money and without any capability of cleaning up and setting out there in the rearing streams of salmon. And all this concern over ice, and the dirt's all over the rug. So we're here ready to do something, and we want to do something.
Just what is it you're going to do?
What we would like to do is to take care of our own house in our own way.
Well, I appreciate that, and I believe you probably would do that, but I also know that there are several requirements in law for insurance requirements or financial responsibility that are there for very good purposes, and that is because even though people have said in the past that they would take care of their own house, it hasn't happened. Now, I'm not saying that you wouldn't, but that's why we have those requirements.
Just a comment to you, it's like the whole fight that the people there put on the Bristol Bay OCS Lithium 92, and if there was an oil spill, that was the concern there. And it was one of the, biggest issues in the district. And, people just fought it. And it's like the same thing, are we going to let it still occur? If we're the cause, no way, not after going through that business. So I'm not, I just want to bring out all the things here. But
I appreciate that. This doesn't only apply to your area, is what I'm getting at.
Well, what I think there's only four cooperatives that are in this situation. That's Nooshigak, Naknek.
There are three Adelaide. There's four with INN. But it's all on the West Coast, and we all take fuel by marine facilities. So I feel that it could be narrowed down to the point saying, yes, we can permit you to do that. By narrowing the scope.
Are there further questions to Claude? Do you have anything to add?
No, I don't.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Jerry, do you want to testify for Nooshigak?
Yes, sir.
I think we need to clarify.
Mm-hmm.
Statute.
Jerry Nelson. I'm here representing Nooshkak Electric in Dillingham, Alaska. And ordinarily, our manager would be here to talk to you about this particular subject, but we're having an annual membership meeting for the telephone co-op this week. And rumor has it that sometimes you can get down to Juneau and not get back home as expeditiously as you might like. So he sent me to talk on his behalf. And I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 149, as did Mr. Frank. And to start off with, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Dillingham, just to reinforce Adelaide's comments a little earlier. Dillingham exists because of the resident herring and salmon commercial fisheries, and many, if not all, of our co-op members are directly involved in these fisheries as commercial fishermen. Most other residents of Dillingham are involved in municipal, state, or federal service programs that have evolved because of this resident commercial fishery. Of the 7 elected members of our board of directors, only 3 aren't directly involved in the fishery as commercial fishermen. My husband and I originally came to Dillingham 25 years ago, where he accepted a position as management biologist for the Department of Fish and Game. Every resident in Dillingham is there in one way or another because of the fishery. I mention these things so you'll recognize that the cleanliness of our natural environment and the waters of Bristol Bay is of vital importance to every member of our co-op. Habitat protection is the number one priority in maintaining that fisheries resource. As you know, Alaska Statute 4604040 requires cooperatives operating fuel storage tanks in excess of 10,000 barrels to submit proof of financial responsibility in the amount of $1 million. Nooshkak Electric falls under the provisions of this statute because of action we took in 1985. And at that time, we were trying to gain some relief from the skyrocketing cost of fuel from Chevron, who was our sole source supplier. And at that time, sometimes the price of fuel would vary 3 or 4 times within a single month. I believe at the time we finished purchasing from them, we were paying $1.14.9 per gallon. In 1985, we obtained a state grant for the construction of 2 500,000-gallon fuel storage tanks on our own property next to our powerhouse. To briefly comment on that construction and our bulk facilities, the tanks are located in a diked enclosure with 5 feet of steel retaining walls. In conjunction with the tank construction, a 6-inch pipeline is buried at depths of 3 to 8 feet, connecting the tank farm to the city dock located some 3,600 feet away. The pipe itself is a combination of Schedule 40 and Schedule 80 steel pipe. All connections were welded by a certified pipeline welder, and a Schedule 80 pipe was used under all the street crossings and under the dock for added strength. When the pipe was completed, we tested it, and it was pressure tested at 250 pounds per square inch. This pressure was held in the pipeline for about 6 weeks, and at that time we manually released it. There are 2 one-way check valves located in the 6-inch line before it enters the diked enclosure and 1 one-way check valve in the enclosure itself. In addition, there are 3 6-inch outside screw and yoke gate valves in the line and 1 at each tank. Our facilities were carefully engineered and inspected and are really first rate. The reason I mentioned the valves is I understand from the gentleman in the corner that there's some concern about what would happen in the event of a spill. And we do have the capability of closing the pipeline at the tank farm itself, also at the city dock, and at one point in between. So basically, you could protect what oil was combined in each section of the pipe and in the tanks themselves. Regarding the measures we have taken to protect the environment and to deal with any problems that might arise, in 1985, NEC completed a Coast Guard-approved oil transfer operations manual and a DCE-required oil spill contingency plan. Our general manager and powerhouse personnel have been trained in implementation of these documents as required by the U.S. Coast Guard and DEC. In addition, the co-op has entered into contracts for potential cleanup services with Alaska Offshore Inc. and Crawley Environmental Services. Since the tank and pipeline project was completed in the fall of 1985, the co-op has received 2 fuel deliveries averaging approximately 900,000 gallons each. During each delivery, a U.S. Coast Guard representative is on site to make sure we're doing everything properly. We've had no incidents or spills. During the fuel transfer operations, which normally take 34 hours, trained utility personnel are present both where they're offloading and at the tank farm where they're receiving the product. deliveries averaging approximately 900,000 gallons each. During each delivery, a U.S. Coast Guard representative is on site to make sure we're doing everything properly. We've had no incidents or spills. During the fuel transfer operations, which normally take 34 hours, trained utility personnel are present both at the dock where they're offloading and at the tank farm where they're receiving the product. These two crews are in contact with each other by radio at all times. In addition, the fuel barge has its own personnel, and there's always one person present at the offloading site and sometimes two or three people. In addition, a Coast Guard representative is present during the entire operation. Considering our previously stated concerns about the health of the environment, why are we asking for relief from compliance with the statute, which only requires assurance of financial responsibility for oil spill cleanup? And the primary reason is that we must have the fuel. But in order to offload our fuel, it is possible that we will in the future be forced to violate Alaska Statute 4604040 as it is written. And this is a problem shared with four other cooperatives that were mentioned earlier in NACNEC, Kotzebue, and perhaps Nome. In 1985, we were okay. At the last minute, we secured spill insurance through ARECA. And we also were able to get a letter of credit from CSC, which is the National Lending Organization for Cooperatives. That brought us up to the $1 million required. In 1986, ARECA couldn't help us out. But we went to our attorney, and with the help of the attorney in the state, we did come up with a $10 million premium policy with a limit of $1 million. But we were told at that time that it was highly likely that this type of insurance would not be available to us in the future. And we were told that the reason is that there is a trend to exclude environmental coverage in liability insurances. If insurance were available to us, of course, we would purchase it. Our manager and our board of directors has taken a little more conservative position along this line than NACNIC's management and directors, but they would be reassured by having a policy in place. If this coverage is not available, however, and we have reason to think that it might not be available, we would have no choice but to offload in violation of statute or to abandon our fuel tank farm facility. And first year would be a real problem because we have a commitment to purchase early in the spring. And the local distributor doesn't stock fuel in sufficient amounts to provide Nishigak Electric's needs for an entire winter. Also, their price runs 15 to 20 cents higher per gallon than we've been able to secure going out to bid. To reinforce Mr. Frank's comments about PCE, we did a quick calculation, and if we were forced to go to a local distributor and pay these higher prices, PCE available to our customers would be about $6,000 greater per month than it is now. NEC currently holds over $1 million equity in its system, and that amount does exceed the amount of financial responsibility assurance that we are required to provide. We've taken all preventative measures suggested or requested by DEC, the U.S. Coast Guard, and common sense measures as indicated by the general manager and the board of directors. In the unlikely event that a spill should occur, NEC's members and directors would expect and demand that their cooperative do everything within its resources to clean up the environment. We would have no choice. We're owned by our members, and that environment is their livelihood. One of two things must happen in order for NEC to continue to legally procure and offload fuel at competitive prices. One, we must be relieved from compliance with AS 4604040 in order to make necessary commitments for purchase and delivery at a time when availability of insurance is uncertain. Or two, we must be assured that adequate oil spill liability insurance is available to us in a timely manner each and every year. Unfortunately, I don't believe the state controls the insurance market. Consequently, we are seeking your support of this House Bill 149 to exempt us from compliance with that particular statute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In Western Alaska, did you say how many co-ops would be affected by this?
I understand that Kotzebue is constructing a tank farm, and I have also heard that Nome is, but I can't confirm that.
Ken, do you know?
I know that there are two co-ops now, and Kotzebue is building more tanks, and Nome is a municipal.
Okay, I would just they're a municipal utility, so they're under their own coverage. I was just considering maybe instead of having everyone have their own individual coverage, why don't you put together a pool? It only affects three now, two and one more that's being built. I mean, it just seems to me, and maybe even the state could provide it, provide the coverage based on some type of risk analysis, I don't know. Maybe even have them pay into disaster relief fund or something, since that's the likely place where we'd end up having to pay out of it. What I'm looking at is cutting down your cost by insuring more than just individuals.
Do you have a commentary?
You said that if it's available, you're going to buy it anyway.
That's true, as long as the premium is something that's within the price of reality.
I haven't seen many insurance policies recently that have.
But basically, we would be comfortable to know that there's a policy out there that would help in case of a major spill.
Well, first off, I don't think, looking at their sheets, citing Alaska Statute 4604.120, where it defines an all terminal facility as anyone who transfers, processes, refines, or stores oil on or near water, doesn't limit it to those four saltwater facilities we're talking about. I think there are a lot more facilities involved than that. Second, we're talking about $1 million coverage, which, in my opinion, is, even so there's six zeros there, is Mickey Mouse. I mean, when you look about consequences of a magnitude spill that could perceivably happen, $1 million isn't much if you're looking at resource destruction or something like that in a spin-off effect. It would look to me that either a state-provided umbrella insurance or risk management or a co-op deal where those facilities get together in either form a self-insuring pool. I mean, $1 million is not much, but I agree. We're talking about $10,400 yearly premium for a comparable low-risk operation. That seems excessive, and when you transpose that over a whole bunch of facilities in the state, the yearly premium alone in no time at all would provide a $1 million bank that could be used by anybody then.
I'm also wondering if maybe we could get some of the ADCs to testify on it, but how would the hazardous this waste response fund
apply
to that?
Let's wait. And then Representative Springer, we'll check out the information about how many, areas this does affect. We'll get that information for you. Representative Pierce, did you have?
Thank you. I don't know. Some of my questions definitely ought to wait for DEC, but from your testimony, it sounds like you have to buy additional insurance above and beyond whatever you have to carry just for your facility, only because you offload. Is this correct?
That's correct.
This is a second amount of insurance. So you have, how much insurance do you have just on your facility, normal insurance year-round in case you have a spill? Or is this part of
this that? This is a separate policy, and a spill isn't covered under our existing liabilities. It's something that we acquire in addition just for this particular operation, just to offload fuel once a year.
Okay, what are your requirements for regular liability insurance for spills? Does the state tell you? Is that laid out in statute?
I don't know that there is any requirement for spills. You know, when we buy our properties, we buy for fire, damage, machinery blow-ups, those kinds of things.
Any further questions?
I'm still not clear on that.
I'm not nodding because I don't know.
Quad?
That's correct?
Yes.
Two policies?
We have a $10,000 policy, and I guess why we're saying that the exposure is for 34 hours is because that's the time it's coming off the barge, going through the hose, going through the pipe, and going to the tank. And we considered that our exposure period, and I hadn't really thought when I was preparing these remarks about what would happen if the tank ruptured as it sat there. But then you do have the retaining wall, and while you'd have to do some pumping, hopefully it wouldn't get past that impenetrable barrier that we have.
our testimony has kind of been mixed pears and apples, because we now talked about an earthquake that would make the entire facility first versus just this transfer, and I am just being confused, and maybe DEC can clear that.
Yeah. Do you have anything to add to that, Ken or Claude, to the questions?
Could I just make a statement about the insurance a little bit in terms of...
Can you just go to
the... Yes, Ken Johnson from Eureka. The Division of Insurance and our broker through the Alaska Public Utilities Insurance Trust, who is Caroon and Black in Anchorage, made a real extensive search throughout the nation for a company, an insurance company, that would issue a policy. And finally, it came up with International Surplus Lines, which is an unrated company, and there's a lot of concern on the part of the utilities and particularly the broker as to whether, if there's a problem, whether that policy will be worth the paper that was written on or not. As a matter of fact, the broker who placed the coverage with the insurer was concerned enough about that company that they required the utilities purchasing the policy to sign a release holding the broker harmless for having the policy with an unrated insurance company. So, and beyond that, the policy is for $1 million, and both of these co-ops have demonstrated that at the drop of the hat that they could produce that kind of cash to clean up an oil spill.
At the drop of the hat?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they could call CFC tomorrow, which is the National Rural Utilities Cooperative Finance Corporation, and get a line of credit, or in the case of Nooshigak, them and through the Eureka Insurance Trust, could come up with that kind of money in no time.
That's not what you said last year.
Amount of money is certainly available
to you. You can demonstrate that financial responsibility to DEC.
But it has to be liquid assets. And the regulations require that the $1 million be in liquid assets. That I think there was a lot of controversy over whether the letter of credit and ability to actually produce that money was satisfactory in complying with the regulation, and it didn't.
Okay. Have you had anybody evaluate a $10,000 policy for 34 hours of exposure at $1 million coverage and the potential risk of that? I mean, I'd like to see an evaluation of that, because personally, I think you're getting screwed.
Well, we know that. We don't have any question about that. It's just that was the only way that we could come up with last year to comply with the law. Do that. That's the only insurance policy we could get.
How many years have you been bringing the fuel in?
Well, those tanks were built in 85.
Right, we've had 2 deliveries.
So you've had to have 2 policies or 1 policy covered 2 years?
We had, the first year we went through Eureka for $500,000, and then we had a line of credit for $500,000. This past year was when we first purchased an actual policy for oil spill.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Davis.
My question is, so the responsibility for the cooperative goes from the moment that it leaves the barge until it reaches the tank, and it's that physical part that you're required to have this insurance for. And specifically for you, it's 34 hours, and for you, approximately 48 hours, and that's once a year.
That's true.
Who mans the pumping? Is it people from off the barge?
The barge is manned by the barge crew. The manifold is manned by the cooperative. The
manifold?
The fuel manifold, where it comes from a flexible hose to the fixed line going
okay.
through the tank line.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's check valves for long lasting.
Now, the flexible part is manned by who?
By the cooperative.
By the cooperative.
No, by the barge.
By the barge. So you're. So then that even lessens the amount of distance that you're cooperative. You're from the fixed manifold to the pipe. And the deliverer or the transportation company, his insurance takes care of it from the moment it leaves the barge, goes through the flexible holes to the permanent manifold.
Right, to the flange.
To the flange.
Yeah.
Any further questions?
Is there someone from DEC here?
Well, I'm just going to go back here. I'm not going to bring them up yet.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to, bring up Christian Allman. He has some, not solutions, but they're looking at ways to maybe transfer the liability to the fuel deliverer. I'd like that to be very brief, and then we'll go on to DEC.
I'm Chris Olmes, Division of Insurance. We have been looking at ways and means to improve this situation. We had last week a discussion with the broker of Lloyd's of London to review one option. It would be the barge comes to those fuel tanks and unloads the fuel. So far, it is my understanding that the utility would remain liable if there is a spill because this unloading of fuel. Now, the insurance industry offers a policy called a Wharfman's policy. This Wharfman's policy would take this liability away from the utility and put it to the fuel supplier. At the present time, a barge operator generally has a policy that excludes that particular peril. However, this Lloyd's of London broker is looking into it to see how much it will cost to make the barge owner liable and put that in the policy. So if there's a fuel spill, the fuel supplier would pay for that through that policy. The consequence of that, it would have a lesser impact on the liability of the on-land storage facility and could create a... And would have an impact probably on the rates. The second piece this Lloyd's of London broker is looking at to find what would a policy cost as enforced right now with the International Surplus Line Company, which is a part of the 15th largest insurance group in the United States. So we're not talking about an insurance company that is such a small outfit that has no backing. This company is part of the 15th largest company with $2.3 billion in writing in 1985 alone. Lloyd's of London will look at it and see what would a policy like this cost at Lloyd's. The third option they're looking at is to see if there is a Wharfman's policy in force, how much would the same policy cost right now to pick up the remaining liability. So, let's see. Yes, please.
Did you say that you felt the liability when you're offloading with the utility?
I guess that's presently the way it's understood, in a sense.
They're suggesting that it's only from the flange to their facility. Well, that's something that's really important, I'd say.
Yes. What Lloyd's of London was saying is, in the past, they have paid claims to that effect. If a barge was unloading fuel into an on-land on a storage unit on land, and there was an oil spill, they have paid for that in the past. And then they've made exclusions into the policies. I understand your point. You say the liability starts when the fuel is in the tanks, but I don't know if that's totally true. I would think it's a matter of what is the contract written and what is really arranged between the fuel deliverer and the utility.
Madam Chair,
Did you have a question? Persons bring first.
You said that Lloyd's of London could transfer the insurance policy basically to the deliverer or carrier through a
what it, Warfman's or
Warfman's policy.
Warfman's policy. But all that does is it's just transfer the milk cow from one place to another, and the consumer would still pay the same thing, or is the policy really cheaper?
The indications I've been giving by Lloyds is that it's definitely much cheaper. Also, what he would mean is that this policy, this fuel delivery, let's assume that the cost is $10,000, the same price they're paying right now. And this $10,000 would be carried by the fuel deliverer. Now, he's not only delivering fuel to one unit, he's delivering unit fuel to several units, and therefore could spread the cost. But we have to keep in mind, this is only one peril, one risk. It's not only the transfer of fuel, there are other possibilities why there could be a fuel spill. And this is just what is considered the main concern, because it appears that most spills happen during the transfer from barges to the utilities. As those several people were talking here before were making clear, they have a very clean operation. And as a result of that, they were able to buy a policy at $10,400. When we are going $10,400, $400 is the tax and all the expenses on top of the price of $10,000. When we were looking last year into the marketplace, the cheapest policy we could come up with would be $30,000-$35,000. Until this company came along and said, hey, that's a good operation, we go for it. That speaks for itself.
Just for your information, there was a letter from Bruin and Black to Dave Hutchinson last year, and number one, it said Lloyd's of London and various companies, this market does not offer onshore pollution coverage and has not done since 1983.
What's the date of this letter?
February 6, 1986.
Okay, there were some changes in the whole marketplace on a worldwide basis, in a state, on a nationwide basis as well. The reason this discussion, this was led with this Lloyd's of London broker, he said that he will get a quote from Lloyd's of London to find out what it's all about. But he considered to be, he's one of the higher people, I think, and he is relatively optimistic that there is a possibility by now. But again, I don't have the information until probably the middle of this week. Then I know more about what it will be, what will the cost be. We have not discussed cost for pollution liability as on land, as we said. We're talking first piece Warfman's policy, second pollution liability on land.
Okay, thanks. Representative Davidson.
My question concerned the flex hose again. I understand that most of the flex hose is the property of the co-op. Is that correct? The flex hose in your situation comes off of the barge, connects to the flange, where it enters into the first stable pipe that's part of the cooperative. Is that correct?
The input line is on the barge, is the barge responsibility, and they own it. The flange is the division point. They own the fuel until it passes that flange. The flange on, we own.
Madam Chair, I guess what I'm having confusion with is the fact that it seems to me that once it passes the flange, the pipe is considered part of the permanent fixtures of the cooperative.
Right.
And so it would seem to me that the insurance policy that you have to cover the permanent fixtures of your cooperative would take that responsibility for the insurance from that point on. And what I'm not understanding is why they have to pay a policy for $10,000 to cover the cost of delivery that utilizes the flex delivery hose, if we may call it that, of the barge company. Why are these people forced to carry the responsibility for that part of the operation? I don't understand that.
I don't think they're forced. It's a matter of contract. Our recommendation to Dave Hutchins last year was also that he would look around to make a deal with the fuel deliverer saying you need a Warfman's policy. Because if there's an agreement saying the insurance company gets a contract saying the fuel is bought the moment it's in the tank, then the delivery of the fuel remains liability with the fuel supplier, mm-hmm. and he would go ahead and, as discussed, to get the Warfman's policy. That would have an impact on the liability exposure of the utility. Now, the unloading of fuel is one risk. It is considered one of the biggest risks, but it's not the only risk. Other risks could be gradual oil leaks, any form of, I mean, an engineer of DEC could give you a better idea about what that all includes, but the most visible exposure seems to be this unloading of fuel, and with a workman's policy, this particular risk could be transferred to the fuel deliverer. And as it sounds like, at a lower cost, totally, let's say $10,000 gets split up on 10 or 20 or 30 utilities versus one. And hopefully, and that's of course something that is that we're checking out right now, what would it cost and still for the utility to buy a policy that would cover the remaining perils, which is of course a lower peril, a lesser risk.
So, Madam Chair, thank you. So, we're really not going to have final word on the workman's policy before March the 25th.
That's correct, yes.
Thank you.
That's what Lloyd's of London was indicating. They will check it out. They will see what they can do. And, I mean, they gave me an idea of what it will cost for the fuel deliverer, but it's I think it's premature to make any statements to that effect at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still not sure where the coverage begins and ends. Does the barge currently have insurance that covers it up to the flange?
Okay, I cannot speak for that necessarily because I haven't seen the contracts and don't know what kind of an agreement they have. But the appearance of it is...
How about typically? I mean, depending, of course, on whose equipment you use, the hose, the flex hose or delivery hose, whatever, depending on whose hose you use, I guess I would just, it just seemed likely to me that whoever's hose that was would be responsible for the hose. The barge would be responsible for anything that happened on the barge, and whoever is at the flange on would be the responsibility of the co-ops.
I would agree with you that this would be the logical explanation. However, again, that's a matter of contract, and if they say we deliver the fuel at this spot, and this spot is a mile from the tank, it doesn't mean that it's in the tank. It's maybe just the moment where they unload it. This is something I don't think that it's, I could answer to you. It's really depending on the individual situation.
The contract spells this out. The contract says we shall supply a flange within 200 feet of the barge. And the barge people have the responsibility of the fuel until it passes through our flange. So it's from barge to flex hose through the flange, and then it becomes our responsibility from that point on.
There's something in the law, too, on civil penalties for discharges of oil. It suggests that if the owner of the oil temporarily transfers ownership of the oil to another person and the transfer has the purpose or effect of evading the vicarious liability, the transfer will be considered the transferor will be considered the owner of the oil for the purposes of this subsection. So if the person says, you're buying it as soon as it leaves the barge, they may not be able to get away from the liability until it approaches your property.
We attempted in our 1984 contract to tank delivery. We had it in the contract for delivery to the tank with just that thought in mind, but they wouldn't accept a bit of that nature. They struck it out.
Okay, I think what I'd like to do is get to DEC now. Thank you very much for your information. Did you? Well, Claude. Okay, Claude.
Who is they now? I assume you're no longer buying from Chevron, but who are you buying from?
We bought from Tesoro last year.
Amy? Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Amy Kyle, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner for DEC. I'd like to ask Paul O'Brien, who's our oil spill program manager, to join me as well in the event that there are technical questions that he can answer. Doug Mertz with the Attorney General's office, who's worked with these statutes and regulations for many years, is here also. So hopefully we can answer all questions and arise. I'd like to start off by just clarifying the purpose of our financial responsibility requirements, because I think that there's been a little bit of confusion in the discussion here about the relationship between financial responsibility and oil spill contingency planning. Essentially, when the legislature enacted the Comprehensive Oil Spill Control Program for the state of Alaska, they established three parts to it. One is a requirement that facilities that handle a certain volume of oil plan to make sure that they handle it properly and that if they spill it, it's cleaned up properly. And that's generally referred to as contingency planning. The second thing that the statute includes is provisions for collection of damages and so on in the event that an enterprise does spill oil. And the third thing is this area of proof of financial responsibility. And I think in the discussion here, the purpose of the financial responsibility requirements has been somewhat confused with the purpose of the oil spill contingency planning. So I want to clarify that. The reason that the legislature established the financial responsibility requirements was to ensure that an enterprise that handles a lot of oil has the capability to both clean it up, the financial capacity to clean it up, and also to pay damages that may result from their spilling of the oil. And both parts of that are important. In an oil spill of any size, there are considerable costs associated with the cleanup. And some of them may go well beyond what can be done by a local labor source. Sometimes you need specialized equipment and a fairly massive mobilization depending on the size. The second thing is, in an oil spill of any size, there also can be considerable damages to the resource, to third parties, and damages that the state would collect. And so the legislature, in passing this program, decided that it was the burden of facilities that handled oil to be prepared to take financial responsibility for both of those things. And I wanted to reemphasize that because I think that there's been a lot of talk about contingency planning and how well prepared the co-ops may be for a spill or to avoid a spill, all of which is very good and which we strongly support. We see that, we agree that the facilities have generally run good operations and have good facilities. But it's not the same thing as making sure that they have the financial responsibility to take care of either the cost of a spill or damages that result from a spill. So I wanted to clarify that.
Could you restate what you said? I didn't quite catch it.
Well, that there are two things that we
just
need.
The last part.
One, that the financial, the ability of a facility to show that they have the financial resources both to clean up a spill and to pay any damages that may come from a spill is distinct from their planning for a spill. They need to do two things. They need to build a facility that is well designed to minimize spills and have a plan to clean up any spills that results that could occur. And they need to show that they're financially able to undertake a cleanup and to pay any damages that may result from a spill. Does that answer the question?
Are you through here?
No.
Okay.
But
okay.
Would you like me to take questions throughout or just continue?
Just finish. Yeah.
The other thing I think it's important to point out is that we've had a long history of working on this issue, and a lot of the correspondence that is in your packet is probably outdated at this point in time. Last year, when the electric co-ops and so on brought this issue to our attention, we spent some time looking into what are really the obstacles to their obtaining insurance, because the issue last year was that insurance was simply not available. And so we spent quite a bit of time working with the Division of Insurance, as well as Representative Herman's staff and Representative Davis's staff, to determine what we could do to make insurance more available. And in the correspondence that's in your packet includes a letter from former Commissioner Bill Ross, as well as a letter from Mike Davis that outlines the various things that we agreed to do. But basically, what we said we would do is fix our regulations in order to change from a requirement for something called occurrence insurance to something called claims made insurance. And I don't want to get into the technicalities of insurance, which I'm certainly not an expert on, and Representative Guevara probably knows far more about it than I do. But the gist of it was that under our past regulations, we required that an oil terminal have an insurance policy that would cover an event essentially in perpetuity. So if you had a policy that ended at the end of this year, but you wanted in the future to make a claim against that policy based on something that you alleged to have happened during that coverage time, that's what we required under our regs. And as you know, the insurance industry has gone through major restructuring in the last couple of years to the point where that type of coverage is simply not available anymore or not readily available. So both we and the Division of Insurance have changed our requirements to something called claims-made insurance, which, again, this oversimplifies, but which means that the insurance is only good for the period that's covered, and you can't come in later on and make claims against it. And this is an important point, because the fact of the matter is that the insurance is available now, whereas it wasn't available a year ago. And I think that the issue is whether $10,000 is a bit too much to pay for insurance, which is a far different issue from we can't get insurance no matter what we do. So when you look at the correspondence in your packet, the letter that probably represents where we're at right now is the last one, which is dated January of 1987. I can't tell who signed it because the signature's cut off the bottom of my copy. And I think it's important to point out that we have done the things that we worked with the legislative staff last year to identify in order to make the insurance available. And in fact, both utilities have been able to obtain insurance this year. We also have agreed not to take any enforcement action against the co-ops as we were resolving all of this, because we did recognize that it was a problem that we all needed to work on. So, with regard to the legislation before us, from our perspective at DEC, it seems to us that it's important to maintain a comprehensive oil spill program. And as we look at this bill, which would exempt one small category of oil terminals, it seems to us that it might be better to continue to work on the insurance issue, which will, we understand, continue to take some work, rather than to simply exempt one class of facilities from the overall approach. From our perspective, it's difficult to think of a policy basis to exclude this particular group. They're not, they happen to have operations of a certain size, but they're not in any way that we're able to tell that different from other types of oil terminals that there's a particular reason to exclude them. We are sympathetic with the notion that local people want to take care of local resources, and I think that's true. And I certainly believe that both of the cooperatives would do everything they could to avoid any oil spills. And I think that that's been reflected in the oil spill planning that they've done and how they've upgraded their facilities. But it seems to us that if you exempt these few facilities, I'm not sure then what you'll do when the next group comes in and asks to be exempted for another set of reasons. And it seems to us that it would be better to continue to, as I said, work with the Division of Insurance as well as the cooperatives to make sure that some form of insurance is reasonably available to them. Another point that I wanted to make is that there was a lot of discussion of self-insurance and the capacity of the cooperatives to essentially take care of these problems themselves. As Representative Cotton pointed out, self-insurance is an option available under our current regulations. It does require that the resources identified for self-insurance actually be available for purposes of cleanup or damages. In other words, they have to be what's called in our regulations working capital or assets. So that there are resources that could be made available without an undue delay. but that it is an option that, that is available. One other issue that is probably worth mentioning is that the notion of recouping the cost of a cleanup or of damages through power rates could, through the power cost equalization program, still result in the state paying a percentage of those costs. So that's another issue that you all, it's not an issue for us particularly, but it's an issue that the legislature might want to be considering. So just to sum up, as I say, we think it's important to maintain a comprehensive program here and to have a good policy basis for any exemptions that would be made. As I say, it appears to us that we've narrowed the issue down here to the fact that the insurance costs $10,000 or something like that, rather than that it was that it's unavailable as it was last year. We're still more than willing to work with the cooperatives as well as members of the committee and the Division of Insurance, to see if there are more things we can do to increase the availability of insurance. Self-insurance is definitely one option that we can work with. So that's what we wanted to say. But we do oppose this bill.
I understand that. I got the point. I was wondering, you know, there was a memorandum to Hal Brown from ex-Commissioner Bill Ross, asking, you know, one question. It was dated July 17, 1986. I was wondering if there was any kind of opinion brought back on that, if we could see that. And then also, if you would agree, you know, with the bill, if there were stipulations that the co-op, you know, take responsibility for the cleanup and damages and things like that.
If I might respond to the first question first, the Attorney General's opinion was requested in order to clarify the amount of coverage that the cooperatives needed to cover. There was some ambiguity in the regulations that that we had decided needed to be clarified last year. Yes, that has been done. It does make it clear that the level of coverage is $1 million rather than $2 million, and certainly we can provide a copy to the committee. With regard to your second question, I'm not sure what sort of stipulations you might suggest. It seems to me that our existing program provides several options for the co-ops to show financial responsibility. And if there's a different option that's available that's not authorized under our existing statute, but that might work, then that might be something where legislation would be helpful. If it's an option that is available under our statute, but which requires some change in our regulations, but which is workable, we'd be interested in pursuing that. As I say, the self-insurance option is already available under our regulations, and so that's the best answer I can give you in the abstract.
So you wanted to have $1 million available in order to clean up the fund. I mean, in order to clean up the spill if it happens, right? I mean, that's the extent.
Correct.
Now, I'm wondering if that doesn't overlap the oil, the hazardous, the oil spill mitigation fund, what used to be. Doesn't the state have money? It's probably underfunded right now, but we'll take care of that later. I mean, I understand that. But wouldn't that overlap? I mean, because the state would go in and take care of that and then recover the money from whoever was responsible, right?
Correct. So it, in a sense, it doesn't overlap at all. That we use the fund in an instance when the responsible party fails to act or when we can't find the responsible party. And then exactly, we do go in and recover our damages. And so this insurance or these other resources would be what's needed in order to essentially replenish or repay the state for its activities and for any other damages the state might assess. So it's not a conflict. The fund was never designed as a state a way for the state to pay this. It's designed to give the department the resources to act on the theory that the damages would then be recovered. And historically, we have recovered damages at the rate that we have expended, though there's usually a couple year lag time for the litigation.
Amy, what about the information that Ken Johnson said that, you know, that any point in time they could get a line of credit of $1 million? What, is that proof of financial responsibility? Or?
I believe that it is that correct? Paul, I'll let Paul respond to that more specifically.
A line of credit per se is not in the regulations. That has been used. What the co-ops have done in the past, I believe, is pooled that to basically self-insure. So it can be used to self-insure as a means of self-insurance.
And as I say, if that's a workable option, it's one that, as I said, we're going to look at any workable option here and continue this process as we did last year of making our regime match whatever's needed to make this more workable.
I'd like to hear back from the insurance division.
Yes.
Workman's policy, yes. And also if they could give me an analysis of the risk involved for the transfer. I just want to.
Okay, thank you. I think that we've come up with a crisis immediately here.
If you have a claim to it, you cannot think of Michigan. They come to us and we have great fields of knowledge.
We always want to reduce your cost off it.
Right.
But I know our condition is if we're forced by insurance, we can go to insurance. Because you do want to get.
We're not trying to risk, and you know, like we're pointing out, in a really worst case, we are in a city of Springfield. The fuel, we got checks on both sides of what's in the tank and coming back out. But they got a gate that can run over there and close, and that gate deal, you can see that it's open, and we got men on both ends and two-way radios. And you're probably only talking about, what is it in the pipe? In the pipe?
Our pipe holds 660 gallons.
Okay, ours is probably a couple of thousand.
Well, you've got what? What's that pipe?
Six and eight.
Six and eight, well. Four inch pipe is 0.66 gallons per foot.
Okay, so ours is probably, let's say it's a gallon.
Yeah, if you got a gallon.
5,000 gallons.
Yeah, you may have got a gallon in there.
And then, so there's a, but half of that's all that's going to go anyway.
Yeah.
Because we got check valves. Okay.
Thanks
a lot. And you're going to see us at the well? Okay. Yeah, okay.
Great.
How do you know through this thing? Just doing
well, there's a reception. What? Well, I don't know. We don't know.
I don't
know.
If you buy a service line policy, this is not subject to the guarantee of association. And because there is no guarantee of association for such a policy, the legislation made the law and makes it by two brokers.
The last I was to see him, he was doing, you know, pretty decent. I mean, you know, for what can be expected. I want to stop by and see him when we're going home. They got him with a prop stash, chopped the hell out of him. What he did is, he had his knee like this, cropped him like that. He was processing his brain, you know, chopped his, all his muscles, chopped his kneecap off and folded it down, chopped the front off the tibia there, and he really hacked him up. And it was about 3 weeks ago.
So what happened?
Well, he's out now. He's over at.
I don't think.
From the operator. And this